Doc Leipzig, the oldest festival for animation and documentary in the world, is happening in a hybrid format in 2020. We're embracing the opportunities that come along with it. Welcome to the new Doc Industry Program podcast, realized in collaboration with What's Up with Docs, the Programmers of Color Collective, and independent film industry curator Temba Bebe. Welcome to a series of discussions on subjects such as story sovereignty, diversity and inclusion in the documentary industry, and decolonizing our industry in general. These podcasts are funded by Creative Europe, the City of Leipzig, the BKM, and MDM. We thank our partners and supporters for their contributions. Enjoy.
Welcome to a special episode of the What's Up with Docs podcast, done in partnership with the 63rd Annual Doc Leipzig Documentary and Animation Film Festival. I'm Tony Bell, the creator and host. I would like to acknowledge the traditional, ancestral, unceded territory of the Tongva and the Chumash on which this podcast is being recorded. We do land acknowledgments as an act of reconciliation that recognizes the traditional territory of the indigenous people who called the land home before the arrival of colonizers, and in many cases still do call it home. In this episode, I speak with award-winning, multidisciplinary visual griot, entrepreneur, art educator, artivist, and ever-growing interstellar tree, Quentin Versetti. Quentin is one of the founding members of the Black Speculative Arts Movement and co-editor of the first Canadian Afrofuturism art anthology entitled Cosmic Underground North Side, an incantation of Black Canadian speculative discourse and understandings. The term Afrofuturism addresses themes and concerns of the African diaspora through technoculture and science fiction, encompassing a range of media and artists with a shared interest in envisioning Black futures that stem from Afro-diasporic experiences. Because Quentin's vision of Afrofuturism includes looking to our past to conquer the challenges of the present so we can create an egalitarian future, this week's song is Chronix de la Move. Here is our conversation, which was recorded in October 2020.
Well, thank you so much, Quentin, for being on the show today.
Yeah, thank you for having me. It's a great honor to be here and to share with you, especially speaking from unceded territories of the indigenous people. And just want to acknowledge the ancestors and acknowledge all their struggles and their sacrifices to allow us to be here. So give thanks.
Amen. Amen. Well, this will be my first conversation about Afrofuturism in the doc space. I'm very, very excited about that. So I just kind of wanted to talk about my experience in delving into Afrofuturism. So I would say my early experiences in Afrofuturism were through my parents, because I am a child of the 1970s, 80s. I was born in 71. So mm-hmm. I was raised around, you know, Parliament, Funkadelic, like all of that. But we didn't call it Afrofuturism then. But then in 2005, I remember exactly, I was living in Florida, and a friend of mine, her name is Thea Moore, we're still Facebook friends. She told me about Octavia Butler. And I was had always been an avid reader, but I had never heard about Octavia Butler. And over the subsequent months after that, like 9 months, I read everything by her. And then I happened to hear an interview that she did on Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman. And then soon after that, she had passed away. And her work really profoundly changed me. So I started out with The Parable of the Sower. That was my entryway into her. And it really dawned on me how I had never really thought about Black folks in the future. Now, that's interesting for me because I am an avid Star Trek fan. I'm a Trekkie. Like through and through. I watch every episode like over and over again, except for, I haven't watched the new ones yet. Still kind of catching up on those. But And, you know, but I was raised, me and my grandfather, we would watch Star Trek in syndication in the 70s, like on CBS, local CBS channel. And like rewatching that, Gene Roddenberry's vision of space and the democratization of space was really prevalent. And if you look at that, you see, I mean, obviously, you know, Captain Kirk is white and McCoy is white and, you know, Spock is Vulcan, and but Uhura is a sister on the bridge. But throughout, they're like Asian and African folks who are scientists throughout that. But, you know, when you think about the future and Blackness, I had never really kind of considered that. But then another part piece of it was being Black in America. And just so people know, you're Black in Canada, but being Black in the United States, there is so much emphasis on us understanding our past and honoring our past. And I think there's so much focus on that because we're trying to learn from it, see where our ancestors have been, see whose shoulders we've been standing on. That, and then there's a survival piece of being in the immediate present. We haven't really had time to really think about so much what our future is.
Exactly.
Yeah. So I just wanted you to speak to that, if you could, and just kind of relate it to your experience as a Black person in Canada.
Yeah, definitely, definitely. yeah, there's so much to speak on that. For me, my entry into it is reggae, you know, being of Jamaican descent. We actually like to say that we originated it. You know, we originated the whole Afrofuturism movement only because they say Rasta always looks to the future, you know. And so when you think of people like Lee Scratch Perry, King Tubby, and, you know, some of the early dub sounds, right, there was already soundscapes that were futuristic, you know. And a lot of it was about time travel, you know, and this idea of going to this mystical Africa and going back to Africa, right? So that's what they say, that, you know, we kind of originated it. And we always say that Americans bite us, you know. So we always like to make it seem like we're the leaders of the free world, you know. But anyways, you know, like listening to The Scientists, which was a dub group, and so many others, like, you know, I just really got into, and even like Peter Tosh, like a lot of Peter Tosh's stuff was very sci-fi, and like he had some mystical elements within it. And so when I did come across Octavia Butler, that's when I started to go nose deep into it, because it just all made sense. Like, you know, for me, I was just like, yo, this really sums up my experience. And I'm trying to remember who said this quote, and it's not coming to mind right now, but it was like this idea of like the Black experience is an alien experience, you know. And for me, you know, living in Canada and then traveling the world, I realized that is very much alien to people. People are like, yo, there's Black people in Canada, you know. And it's like, how did y'all get there? And it's like the same way Black Americans got, you know. Some people don't realize how vast Blackness is. And yeah, so for me, like, I grew up in a predominantly Black neighborhood, which also sounds far-fetched in Canada, you know? And so I didn't really know what it meant to be Black outside of that neighborhood until, like, I came across Octavia Butler and started to learn about the idea of, like, the otherness, you know? And then when I started to actually travel outside of my neighborhood and start to see how white people treat me, I was like, oh, this is for real. So I would say for me, my experience was very different, because I always did think of Black people being in the future, but I didn't think about how important it is to also show other Black people being in the future, you know? And so that's where it started to become a part of my work, because I realized it was important for other young people in my neighborhood to see themselves reflected in the future, because I felt like a lot of us were making choices, poor choices, based on thinking that we're limited to what the options that we're given. And so for me, I'm very much into like community work, and a lot of my work started there. And so Afrofuturism just became that tool for me, you know. So it just went from, it went from being like that thing I grew up with through the music and culture to being now the tool that I'm using to engage and essentially help save lives.
Okay. All right. So I want to go back a little bit to the Black experience as being alien, and something you said about how when you would travel, people were surprised that Black people were, there were Black people in Canada. I know as a citizen, well, I guess in theory of the United States, when I have traveled overseas, this has definitely changed, and I think because with the presidency of Obama, but it seemed like before that when I would travel, people would, when I would describe myself as American overseas, they would make some assumption, oh, well, you're not like a real American. And now if a white person has said that to me here in the United States, I'll be mad as hell. But for someone overseas, it didn't really make me so angry because I look at the, I consider the media depictions of Black folks overseas and how, you know, they consume a lot of this, the same media about us that is consumed here. So I could understand that to a certain degree. And then when I would have conversations with these folks about the racial dynamic or the racism that happens in the US, there's definitely more understanding of that. However, they seem blind to their own racism that they exhibit within their own countries. And I think James Baldwin has a quote about how, you know, being, particularly being Black in the United States is basically, there's not really a sense of a home in a way, you know? And I know my experience is different from yours because what are you like second, third generation?
Yeah, I'm second.
Yeah, second generation, yeah. So my people were brought over here via slavery like during the 1700s. So there's really no memory of like anything but, you know, and obviously like being in Jamaica, the boat stopped there first for your people, but you had time to kind of build your culture up in Jamaica. So just this idea about the alienness, that Black folks being sense of alienness or otherness, is that, do you feel like that's something, well, in the context of Afrofuturism, that is something that we've adopted as Black people that's projected onto us, or something that we've had to adopt as a means of survival?
It is something that it's a little bit of both, to be honest. Because also for me, traveling back to the continent of Africa, like I recognize also the otherness that existed there, you know? And then also it encouraged me to want to learn more about how did that occur? Like, you know, how is it that in some pockets they're gonna be like, oh, you're my brother, and in some pockets it's like, oh no, like you're the outsider, you know? and then how do we find that bridge, you know? And so I think a part of the survival in that is finding unity within the otherness through intention, you know? And so that's one of the things I felt like it's so powerful about American culture that I feel like for Blacks in Canada, we're kind of lacking and we're trying to get there, is that the intention was, yo, we can strive and survive despite the bullshit that they throw at us. Sorry, I don't know if I can say it. Because the thing is, like, again, that cutoff in history for Americans, because it has lasted for so long, that otherness you have kind of unified through that, you know, and you have created your own culture, created your own identity in that, and there's so much power in that and recognizing that, you know, and then for a lot of, like, for example, in Canada, like, we identify with that, you know, we identify with that, but then a lot of us have roots other places, and so that unification and that development of the power in that otherness is not as prominent, as yet, you know? Like, the Jamaicans still deal with the Jamaicans, the Nigerians still deal with the Nigerians, you know? The Ghanaians are still over there, so the Somalis are over there, you know what I mean? We're all kind of... But then on top of that, then we also have Black Francophones who were here first. So one of the people I love to bring up in my conversations is Matthew DaCosta. And there's so much missed opportunity to bring him up into conversations that I try to bring him up as much as I can, because he rewrites history. And to me, next to Marcus Garvey, he's like one of the most important Black historical figures in the West. And it's because he was the first documented African in North America who wasn't a slave. He came here in 1603 to Canada, and he was a French translator. He was a translator for the indigenous people with the French explorers at the time. And the reason why he's significant is because he came here with his own ship. He came to Canada with his own ship, with his own crew of Moors. And so the whole reason why I'm saying he's important, and in the context of Afrofuturism, is because you have to now speculate, how did his brother know the language of the indigenous people if he hasn't been here already? And he's documented also working with the Dutch, with people in Holland, and also with the Spaniards. So this is a pretty business savvy and intelligent brother to know so many languages. And so in one of my stories, I speculate that he's a time traveler, you know, and that he's planting seeds for our freedom, you know. And but there's a whole community that came who are descendants from those who came on his ship as contracted workers, not enslaved people. Because slavery didn't start until 1620. So he was a full 18 years ahead, right? And so, or 17 years ahead. And so I love bringing them up into the conversation because for the Francophone community, the Black Francophone community, that's a whole nother dynamic that like is not discussed about, right? And it's beautiful because, yeah, people don't know about him, but it's a beautiful thing to look into because half of Africa is French. You know what I mean? Half of Africa is Francophone. So there's a whole, it's like side of like our otherness that we still have to discover. And so that's what I love about Afrofuturism, because the learning opportunities in it is endless.
Right. Absolutely. Absolutely. So I actually watched an interview with you.
Why would you do that?
Because... part of my research.
Appreciate that.
And I was just so moved by what you said about the influence of your grandfather, mm-hmm. but also, well, actually, talk about your granddaddy. I'm from Georgia, by the way, so my Southern might come out.
Yeah,
so.
I heard it.
Granddaddy,
heard it.
Yeah. I love my granddaddy. Yeah, tell me about your granddaddy, then I want to ask you about a few other things.
Yeah, so a lot of people might recognize that I have like a lot of Kuji sweaters. And I got my sweaters from my granddaddy, you know what I mean? My grandpapa, as you call him. He went by the name of Jeepers. And he was just a really proud Black man who was self-made in a lot of senses, in a lot of ways. He was an engineer also. He created bicycles. And he is a second generation of a man named Baba Tunde, who came directly from the continent. So the African pride in us was instilled from early, you know, because we were able to trace our roots of the Ewe people through my grandfather and through my great-great-grandfather. And so my grandfather was a storyteller. He used to tell me so many stories. He's the one who told me about the Nancy stories, and which comes from West Africa. And the Kuji sweaters for him kind of like was like that link back to Africa, you know. To him, he said it reminded him of like African patterns and stuff, you know. And so a lot of the things I inherit now, and like even just the way I dress now, like with my fedora hat and stuff, like that's my grandpa's swag right there all the way. But overall, like just spending so much time with him and just like learning so much about him, about the Jamaican culture, and just like also like, you know, linkage to the stories of those who came before me, it made me realize I have an accountability, you know, not only just to him, but to my next generation, you know what I mean? So I use this term called Sankofanology, you know? Yeah. And so it's just this idea of like the past, present, and future is all connected, you know? And I remember there was a time where I felt like giving up. And I was told when I was in Africa to call upon your ancestors, you know? And so I called upon my grandfather and he appeared to me in a dream and he was standing beside a young man and a young lady, you know? And I was just like, boom, bat, ratted. Is that my future descendants? Like, you know what I mean? And it was just like, yo, if you give up now, then you're giving up on this whole lineage of greatness, you know? And so I was just like, yo, the things I do now, I have an accountability to not only make my grandfather and my great-grandfather's proud, my great-grandmother's proud, but also those who are coming after me, you know? So they can look back at me and say, yo, boom, I'll fit my grandpapa that, you know? So, and that's what Afrofuturism is about, right? You're planting that seed for even if you don't get to see the fruits of your labor, you know, at least you know that seed is in the ground. And even if that seed doesn't flourish in the ways that you want it to, that seed just being in the ground alone is enough nourishment for that will come after.
I'm getting emotional now. No, only because like this is so in line with my thinking, and it brings about a lot of stuff. So of course, like you know, we are in this country dealing with this crazy ass election that's about to come up, mm-hmm. and I remember during 2016, like I wasn't excited about Miss Hillary. I have a lot of friends, like Black friends, who weren't excited about her at all. But I'm like, okay, we need to vote for her because this other thing is a straight up fool. Like he's crazy. And, you know, and a lot of people who I knew who are activists in the Black community were just like so adamantly against her. She's problematic as hell, obviously, but a different kind of problem. And I remember saying to someone, you know, I may not, whether they're talking about all these things that she would not do. I'm like, okay, granted, she's not going to do these things. Okay. But I'm thinking, okay, we won't have to deal with these other factors. And it's a plus, it's not about us. Mm. You know, we need to think about those. We may not see the benefits of, or the pain of what may come after this, but we have to think about that. And I'm kind of like thinking in short-term context, like, you know, Supreme mm-hmm. Court appointees, because that's so important, you know, and judicial appointees here in the United States. But, you know, that has future implications. But also, when you think back to, you know, my grandmother's great-grandfather was enslaved. Mm-hmm. I'm sure he dreamed of freedom. Mm-hmm. Probably had no idea what that would look like, but he dreamed of that for his children, mm-hmm. you know. And then my grandparents, they were sharecroppers, mm-hmm. and they, back in the day, you know, the white folks felt like if you were going to be a sharecropper, you were only worthy of getting like an eighth grade education. There was nothing beyond that. Okay. That did not teach my grandfather from touting the importance of education. And I'm not talking about like just in the schools, mm-hmm. you know, because the schools sometimes don't teach you a lot, but just having that curiosity and that thirst for learning wherever you can, you know, mm-hmm. And I like school. I have like 3 master's degrees. My grandfather never would have been able to like envision that for himself, mm-hmm. you know, but then also the accountability piece is so important too, because I absolutely do feel like I have an obligation, like in every aspect of my life, in my day job, which has its challenges because it's in a predominantly white institution and have to deal with sometimes daily, not so much. That's one of the good things about the pandemic, a little bit of separation there, but just having to deal with like, okay, I'm not going to be complicit in this move that perpetuates white supremacy, even if in its, and white privilege, even if it's the smallest, tiniest ways. Mm-hmm. You know, we do have a little responsibility towards that, mm-hmm. because I feel like I have, like I owe that to my grandparents and the people, those who came before and who did not have the opportunities, who came, the opportunities that I did, as well as those future generations whose opportunities I can't even imagine. Mm-hmm. You know, so yes.
Thank you for sharing that. And yeah, because within that is like recognizing that you are an ancestor, you know? And so if the past, present, and future is all connected, then you're not disconnected from the past or the friend or the present, you know what I mean? Or the future, you know? And so it's all interconnected, right? And so that's one of the things I love about Afrofuturism, because you realize you're within that spectrum, and it's not, and so like, you know what I mean? Within Rastafari, we talk about knowledge itself, right? And one of those things is that recognizing that time is not linear. It's not from point A to point B. It overlaps, right? An example of that is the fact that we're on Zoom right now dealing with three different time zones. We're dealing with the past, present, and future right now. You get what I'm saying? So it's not theoretical what I'm saying. You get what I'm saying? It's literal. And so by recognizing that our ancestors are with us, they can empower us in so many ways that we can't even imagine. And I love the quote of like, we are our ancestors' wildest dreams, you know? And I love telling youth that as well, you know? I love telling myself that, you know? Not to make myself feel good, but to make myself know that you're here and your ancestors didn't even imagine you being there. So keep going. You get what I'm saying? Because when you keep going, those who are going to come after you are going to be like, oh, okay, this is how far he got. I can take even further, you know?
There's a hope for that. That's yeah. A hope for that. So I want to get back to the Sankofa analogy. Have you seen the movie Sankofa, right?
Of course.
Okay, all right. Okay, so for those of y'all who don't know, Sankofa is this, well, it's a term. There's a movie called Sankofa that came out during the, I think it's the 70s, maybe. Mm-hmm. And it's about this sister who's a model. And I think she's at Gori. I think it's filmed there. But anyway, one of the places in West Africa where we were, black folks were shipped from. To come to part of the triangle.
It was supposed to be Cape Coast, but I think they filmed it in Gori. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. So basically, she's a model doing this fashion shoot on this place of this land, the soil that is really rooted in horror. And while she's there taking her fancy pictures and her beautiful clothes, she gets transported back to the times of slavery. Mm-hmm. Very similar to in vain to like Octavia Butler's Kindred. Mm-hmm. And she has an awakening about her past and her responsibility to her people, and as she gets a rude awakening about the brutality of what it was like, you know. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I encourage y'all to go out there and see that. But also I wanted to ask you about Rastafuturism. I have like all these terms that you use that I wanted to ask you about. So Rastafuturism, which I think you probably alluded to a little bit already in our conversation.
So one of the things that was interesting for me, at least in Canada, in Toronto and in Montreal, because I bounce back and forth between both cities, is the rise, I would say, of veganism. And the rise, because, you know, marijuana, cannabis use is legal now in Canada. And so the rise of ganja using, you know, and the profiting off of both aspects. And then as I see in people we're in red, green, and gold all over the place. And I'm like, what is going on? And it was just interesting to notice this, but also like going again to Ghana and to visiting to South Africa and Zimbabwe and also just being connected with people in East Africa, just the rise also of Afrobeats being a reflection of reggae, you know, and how powerful reggae music has been and is still growing, with like artists like Coffee and Chronix and Protégé, et cetera, John Nine. And so Rastafuturism is essentially like how the elements of Rastafari, the ideas of unity, inity is what we call it, and the liberty in it is being propelled and being promoted as the ways to move towards the future. And so I know like within the height, I can't say the height, but at a certain peak within the what we call the plandemic, plandemic, yeah, them plan the panic. but yes, the thing that we're going through right now in the world, a lot of people were suggesting to eat healthy and to focus on spiritual enlightenment and focus on self, et cetera, et cetera. And a lot of the principles came from Rastafari, you know. So like now, like yoga is a big thing, like, you know, all these different things. And a lot of people are taking elements from the Rastafari liberty again, because it's not a religion, it's not a culture, it's a way of life. And essentially we're seeing that as the ways to live better for the future, you know? So now we're seeing more people grow their own food. Now we're seeing people saying, oh, we need to go organic, no more GMO. And blah, 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 you know? So all these different things are elements of Rastafuturism.
Right, right. Yeah, I would definitely say this pandemic, plandemic, whatever, 2020 has really, I mean, I know for me personally, but a lot of folks who I've talked to has really made it, it has brought clarity. Mm-hmm. Because it's brought clarity to the things that you want in your life and the things that you absolutely do not want in your life. Like, mm-hmm. that contrast has been becoming very, very clear. And it's because, you know, I'm single. It's just me in my apartment with my two cats. So my only interaction with people is primarily through this little screen on my computer, you know, as many. And but it really does cause you to like focus on the things that matter. And I'm having very little patience for the bullshit. Mm-hmm. You know? And trying to get clear about like things that I want in my life and also about how I want to live, you know. Mm-hmm. Like, mm-hmm. You know, particularly like I live in an apartment in LA. I don't have a balcony I could go out on, you know. Mm-hmm. So, and I'm like, okay, I want a house. Like, I want a garden. You know, I want to be able to dig in the dirt and go outside. Like, these things are things I think about regularly now. Whereas mm-hmm. before, when I was just getting in my car and going, like, I wouldn't give a second thought to. So, yep. Absolutely. Okay, and then talk to us about Afrotopia.
Mm. So that's not,
yeah.
Yeah, that's not my term, but okay. It's definitely a term I use in my work. I first heard it from John Jennings and from Stacey Robinson, mm-hmm. Amazing comic book artists, illustrators, and also just like four front runners within Afrofuturism. Mm-hmm. And essentially it's the ideal space for people of African descent to exist.
Okay.
And for me, I use in a Canadian context of saying it's the safe spaces, the braver spaces for Black right. people to exist.
Okay.
You know, because, you know, our population in Canada is relatively small. Mm-hmm. So it is a fantasy, of course, to imagine that there will be a city that is just pure black people, you know what I mean? And but also we acknowledge, and from the Canadian standpoint, we acknowledge the indigenous population. And mm-hmm. and acknowledge the indigenous territories and lands that we are on. And so within the Afrotopia, it's very much inclusive, you know?
Right.
And it's not just black people, and it's not all about black people, but it's like we need to feel like we are safe here. That's the Afrotopia. That's all we ask for. You know what I mean? Where we're not getting shot. We're not having to worry about being miseducated in our schools. We're not worrying about being poisoned for whatever reason. We're not worried about syphilis coming into our community, cocaine and ratete and blase blase.
We medical feel experimentation.
Safe. Yes.
None of that.
And so I have an art piece called, which actually connects everything together, called Dance for Her Pride.
Okay.
And actually, funny enough, I wanted that art piece to actually be a short film.
Mm-hmm.
And in wanting to turn it into a short film, that process was really revealing to me. So it's an art piece where it has four elderly, what I call them grandmas or aunties, and they're dancing.
Mm-hmm.
And they're dancing like in a futuristic like type landscape. And then there's four lioness, like, you know, just looking over them, guarding them, protecting them, you know. But it's almost a direct reflection.
Right.
And they're dancing in front of the gate, the Black Star Gate in Ghana. Mm-hmm. It says freedom and liberty. And the idea is like the Afrotopia is that space where my grandma, when she gets in the spirit, she can feel safe enough, what we say, tech wear herself, you know what I mean? Tech wear herself in public, you know what I mean? She doesn't have to worry about people watching her or who wants to sue her and say what about her, you know? She feels safe enough to engage in her Afrocentric practices of being the spirit when it happens, you know? And so that would be my ideal space, because if my grandma can feel safe, essentially that trickles down, you know what I mean? Because that's the most, in my opinion, one of the most vulnerable people in our community, especially right now in this pandemic, you know what I mean? The elderly, the most, you know, vulnerable. But so in wanting to do that short film, they kind of, like, most of the elderly women who I approach, they objected because they're like, you know what, like, what about this, what about that, what about this? And it made me realize that we're not living anywhere close to an Afrotopia because...
Some of their specific concerns?
So I really wanted to shut down a street, like a shut down, like an intersection, and just have them do their thing, like have one drumming, have next one do their, you know what I mean, pounding, do that, you know what I mean, just doing what I feel like is very essential parts of the culture and things that they love, you know, not me projecting on them. For example, I had one elderly woman who she does a lot of knitting, and I was like, well, would you be open to just knit in this scene, you know? And everyone just had different concerns, you know, of just like the coordination of it, you know, police. Like, it was also during the time where there was a lot of police brutality and stuff like that. And so Black Lives Matter protests and stuff like that. And so I was just like, wow, like,
this that is fear, actually a fear lot of the more... visibility.
Yeah, yeah, fear of the visibility, fear of being targeted, fear of being recognized, you know what I mean? And so I was just like, yo, wow, like, you know what I mean? Like, it humbled me as a man on so many different levels, because I was like, yo, I didn't realize. It also made me aware of my male privileges, you know what I mean? And also, my ignorance, you know, because it's like, and also in a way it was very patriarchal, you know, because here am I thinking like, okay, boom, if I'm doing it and you trust me and that we have this relationship, then I should be enough to make you feel protected. And that's not the case, you know what I mean?
Right.
And so anyways, I say all that to say, I turned it into an art piece representing five elderly women from different continents that I met in this scenery to show that this is what I would like to see. Like, this is my hope, you know what I mean? This Afrotopia, you know what I mean?
Right,
but also, it's still Sankofanology because it is reflecting on the times where we did have safe villages and safe communities,
yes,
you know, where women did feel protected and valued, et cetera, et cetera.
I mean, I think that sense of safety is so important and something we just don't have. And not even like in the day to day. Yeah, I was born and raised in Georgia. I've been in LA for 10 years. But I was living in, and not saying things weren't the best in Georgia. I mean, definitely Georgia has its issues, but it wasn't until I came to Los Angeles that I became like hyper conscious, like more than I ever was in other places of the cops here. You know why? Because even back during the 70s and 80s, we heard about the reputation of the LAPD and its treatment with towards Black and Brown folks. So, and then with just, I don't even think it's a rise in police brutality. I think it's just more visible.
Yeah, more documented.
You know, because when we think about the Watts Rebellion during the 1960s, that was caused by a police stop. A brother was driving his pregnant wife to the hospital. She's about to go into labor. And cops stopped him, reached into the car, and shot him. And like, oh, ain't nothing new. And they got away with it. No, ain't nothing new. But also, it's interesting you bring up the police brutality in Canada, because as a Black person in America, when I travel to other places, and I mentioned this on a podcast Ranelle and I recorded with a filmmaker from Turkey, but they live in Germany now. Their name is Ruskar Bruski. And I was telling them how when I go to Germany in Berlin, like I actually feel comfortable like walking around more so. And they were quick to point out that, oh, well, if you were a Black man, it'll be a different situation because there is police brutality that exists there. And I stand corrected. But I said, at least I don't have to worry about getting shot. You know, that's something. But, you know, just a sense of safety and on guardness. And like when I'm going into a store and just going into the store and like the feeling of being watched. You know, just a sense, this hyper-vigilant coat that you have to put on to exist in the world. And it's interestingly enough, that I feel like with this pandemic, I think one of the many reasons why, well, obviously it's disturbing because people are dying, but the whole world, and when I say the world, I mean, even including white folks in the States, are having to become cognizant of the people who are around them and who are near them. And it's something they haven't ever had to deal with before, except now they're like making sure people have their mask on and that type of thing. But I'm like, okay, like, welcome to our world. But it doesn't mean it's less stressful for me, you know? But it's just, yeah, but this whole Afrotopia, and I don't know, have you seen the show Key and Peele? Do you remember that little skit Negro Town? But in a sense, in the skit, Key or Peele, whichever one, he gets knocked out, and he wakes up. He's being stopped by the cops, and he gets knocked out by the cops. But he wakes up in this Negro Town, which is essentially this Afrotopia, where people are like Black folks are dancing and singing and they don't have to worry about being shot by the cops or stopped by the police. They don't get followed in stores. You know, no one's asking them for their ID. It's Negro Town, you know? And, you know, just being able to, that's something we are always hopeful for.
Yep.
You know, to be able to live and to be able to exist. And I think that's probably what some of the appeal, well, of course, like Black Panther was just amazing.
Yeah.
But just to have that vision of a country, Wakanda, and that had never been impacted by colonialism, and the possibilities of that, like it's like this vision of what we could have been.
Yeah, I mean, and Afrotopias exist, right? They exist. They're out there. You know, I've seen them.
you know, so it's possible. I mean, so I've been watching a show called Lovecraft Country, and it's the podcast that gets me, because I love the film. I already love the show, and just the conversations that they have about the show that makes me go deeper into it. And so one of the things that was interesting in terms of the conversation was how when you are so accustomed to being colonized, how you take on the coloniality, you know? And so that's why I had that hesitation in my voice, because it's like, I know a lot of these places, they're mindful and they're cautious and wary of how the coloniality might show up, because it will show up, you know, it will show up. Exactly. And so that's another interesting part of Afrofuturism. And I don't know if you've been up on the conversations that have been happening lately about African futurism versus Afrofuturism, and how they're trying to create this like separation in terms of the distinction, because a lot of the conversation, and I'm glad that I've been included in the conversation, to present the Canadian perspective and Jamaican perspective, because a lot of the conversation felt like Afrofuturism was very American centric and was just glorification of American ideas of African people, you know? And so people felt like it was a representation of coloniality in a way, because it's like, this is what Americans want for the future, you know? And that was really interesting, you know, that was really interesting to then think about it, because it's like, yeah, what different people in different spaces want for the future, of course, is going to look different, you know? And it's important for us to recognize that us as Black people, to recognize that Black is not a monolith, you know, and like to remember that there is a spectrum of Blackness, and how that looks and how we engage with it is going to be completely unique to each region, you know?
Right. So did some of this conversation come up with the release of Beyonce's latest visual album? I haven't seen it yet, because I'm not yes. willing to pay for the Disney Plus yet. But I remember seeing a lot of stuff out there. Yeah. And yeah. like the...
And yeah, Black Panther 2.
Black Panther 2. Okay, yeah.
Because... And that was my gripe originally with Black Panther. Like, when I first watched it, I didn't love it.
Oh, you didn't? And
because, okay. Sorry if I offended you.
No, you're okay. All
right, because as someone who loves science fiction, I wanted to see the imagination push further.
Right.
As like someone who went to the continent and like been to different places in the continent and very much... self-proclaim to be Afrocentric, it's mm-hmm. like where is the actual imagination of the Afrocentricity of Wakanda to make it unique versus
right.
you're actually just sampling and taking things from an already existing Africa and placing it in one place, you know?
Right.
And so gotcha. Okay. So that's what bothered me at first, because I was like, yo, wait, what? Why did he do that? What? Where's the context? What? You know, this is a disrespect thing, like, you know what I mean? So
right.
Because also for me, I was raised with protocol, or I wouldn't say I was raised, but I was taught to have protocol. So there's certain things mm-hmm. I know requires protocol for you to do certain things, you know? So,
right.
For example, a simple one in the waterfall, the waterfall ritual is yeah. like, you had people out of context, you know what I mean? In the sense of like what they're wearing,
and
why they're wearing it there at that place, like that's out of context. Like, you know what I mean? Like some people are wearing funeral attire, some people are wearing birth attire, like, you know what I mean? So mm-hmm. some people are wearing wedding attire, like, you know, and it was just out of context.
It makes sense visually. Yeah.
And I was just like, I could just hear some of my elders like cussing,
So when I checked in with some of them, they're like, yeah, like we felt like it was too much of like trying to put too many aspects of like what American thought was interesting about Africa into
versus what was actually yeah.
And so the reason why it bothered me, because I was like, yo, why couldn't it be like the Klingons? Like, you know what I mean? Why couldn't it be like, in the sense of like, no, I'm saying it in the sense of like inventing a whole culture, inventing a whole new language, inventing a whole new thing that we've never seen before. Because a lot of these things we've seen before.
Yeah. Because the Klingon, even though I do not like the new Klingons.
And I shouldn't be hating on them because it's being shot in Toronto and in Canada, but
I know. I kind of wish they stuck to the war version of Klingons. And plus, it just doesn't. But anyway, there's definitely this distinct language and culture and like way of being. Yes. But I'll tell you one thing that I didn't like about Black Panther at the end when they basically reveal that Wakanda existed, and like, why would you make that public? Because you know how these colonizers are. Like, I could get you okay and want to fuse things into the Black community, like, but do that on a down low. You don't need to tell everybody.
And to me, the weirdest thing of the film that shook me and irked me was your first Wakanda center or Vibranium center is going to be in California. Like, I was like, make it make sense. Your first one, like before you go back to Nigeria where you picked up your girlfriend from and helped out the people out there who are fighting the Boko Haram, you're gonna jump the whole continent like that. Make it make sense. Before you made the whole continent like Wakanda, you're gonna jump to America where they're gonna take it. Like, right by Silicon Valley. Right by... Come on, fam. Like, I love you, Coogler. But, like, that was the most American move ever. And, I get it. You try to link it back to Marvel. But it was just, like, it made no damn sense. Just like Storm. I'm going on a rant. But just like Storm as X-Men makes no damn sense. Just think about it. And it pissed me off every time. And I love Halle Berry. And I love all the different actresses who play step into that role, but like I'm just waiting for someone to be like, yo, this doesn't make any sense. You're a level 5, you're a god, you're a goddess. You're level 5 mutant. You when Professor Xavier found you, you were changing the weather in Africa and another like why are you flying in a plane? If you can control the you know what I'm saying? Like if you can control the elements. If you can control the elements, what are you doing in a jet, flying in a jet, when you can fly? And they always make her so whimsy. Like, you control, like, right now, the pandemic is killing a lot of people because of respiratory issues. This goddess controls the air. How many of the bad guys can she kill at one time? Just be like, the winds suck off your oxygen. You're dead. It just made no sense. Like, why they made her, like, she's a level 5 mutant when they found her. And then she just plays sidekick.
Hollywood always got to center whiteness. Yeah. You know, so. I have mixed feelings. I'm still mad at Halle Berry about Monsters Ball. But anyway, that's.
But. In regards to the Beyonce, I think there was a lot of controversy with that film because it wasn't clear on where the coloniality actually ends and where Beyonce's coloniality begins and then where African coloniality is at the forefront. Because a lot of people felt like it was just a glorification of wealth.
That's a criticism that's been leveled against the Carters. Well, I remember when the that whole That song they came out with that they filmed in the Louvre.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, and then everybody was like all excited about that, and you know, and one of the lines, and I hope we don't have to pay her for this. This I can't believe we made it.
Yeah.
But like, but I'm thinking that I'm like, okay, but made it according to who? Mm. And according to whose standards?
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I mean, there's definitely a lot of, in their work, there is like a glorification of the tangible monetary wealth, like, which is like something that's glorified in Western culture, like the acquisition of wealth by all means, and the celebration of those who have, and really the deification of those who have wealth as well. Okay, so I want to go into kind of speaking of your work and what we tend to glorify. Because when I was looking through your portfolio and I visited your website, you know, your work is so clearly very expansive. And you really talk about, and one quote from your website says, you really try to bring into focus like what is actually visible/invisible in our society. And that phrase made me think about Richard Wright's Invisible Man. And I remember when I read this first time when I was in high school, you know, classic United States literature, but it was always problematic to me because but I really didn't come into conscious as to why it was until like much later when I was reading a James Baldwin quote about the book, you know, because it's called Invisible Man, and he says invisible to whom, because this character Invisible Man was all he's trying to be visible and be seen by whiteness. So when you talk about like looking at who's examined who is actually visible and invisible in society, from what context are you entering that space? Like, and who are you? Well, it's clear who you're trying to create visibility for. I mean, as far as Black folks and Indigenous folks being able to see themselves, but what else is there to that?
Yeah. So a lot of it goes right back to the activism work, and my role. Well, the role that I've assumed upon myself as an art educator. And so I'm thinking about the youth, right? Because one of the biggest things, and especially for someone who didn't make the best decisions as a teenager, you know, and being caught up in the streets and stuff like that, and almost losing my life on multiple occasions just because of being in the wrong place, wrong time, doing the wrong things. I made those decisions because I felt like I wasn't being seen. And so I was making decisions that were always short-sighted because I was like, well, I don't even see myself in the future and you don't see me in the present, so who cares, you know? And the work is really letting young people feel seen, letting women, Black women, feel seen, trans folks, elderly, et cetera, you know, those who often get overlooked, the everyday people, you know? And so that's what I was trying to do with my work, you know? And it's like, I want you to see yourself, you know? So I'm trying to show those who I feel like is underrepresented. And then I want you to feel like you are now represented through that representation. And recognize that you now have to represent for yourself now at this point. Because it's like, I'm telling you, just for having 3 masters, you deserve a monument. And you are monumental.
I have a monument of debt.
Well, we're not even thinking about that. I'm just saying, we're not even thinking about that.
Okay, we're not.
For you to think about it. For you to. Exactly, but now it's like, okay, but like, I'm recognizing you for that feat, and I'm celebrating you for that feat, and then now other people are seeing that and they're celebrating you for that, and it's now it's like, okay, well, yeah, I got the debt, but shit, I'm educated, you know what I mean? But shit, I can make, I have options,
You know what I mean? I'm not limited. You get what I'm saying? And I can say I've been there, done that type of thing, you know? And now it's like, okay, well, what I'm going to do now next to be more monumental. So the next thing will be, yeah, paying off that debt and some, you know what I mean? Next thing will be, who knows, start up a loan company because you're so nice, you know? So I'm just saying there's so many different ways that you can keep leveling up because you've already, because that one level has already been acknowledged. And then now it's like you acknowledging it within yourself. And so that's kind of like what that is about.
Yeah. So kind of like tying in the visibility piece and kind of going back to your five elderly women who were fearful of the visibility. So how do you kind of bridge that gap? Because, you know, there is a legitimacy, a legitimate fear in many cases to be visible. Like being visible mm-hmm. in some ways can be dangerous. Mm-hmm. So how do you bridge that gap between, the need for people to see themselves and see themselves reflected correctly, like within spaces that celebrate them and mm-hmm. love, that demonstrate they love them, but also help them to get over, not even get a hump, get through that fear, mm-hmm. that legitimate fear.
Yeah, so this kind of goes back to Beyonce, actually, and Black is King, because for me, my work is centered around protocol. So I need, if I want to represent you, I need to check in with you. I need to make sure you're comfortable with it. I need to make sure I got your consent, and that you kind of know what I'm about to do or want to do, which is why I often shy away from representing celebrities, you know? So if one does not feel comfortable, or if I can't get them to be actually involved in the work, then it's like I'm representing their idea, an idea of them, right? So it's like, yes, I didn't get to represent those elders within my immediate community, but I represented them as an idea through different people, you know? And it's like, through representing them, I'm still honoring you. Because you inspired me, you know, to want to create something in the first place. And so that's kind of how I go about it. Because also for within the aspect of Sankofanology, is like recognizing like who I represent is gonna mean different things to different people, you know? So, yeah, I don't know if you want me to elaborate on that.
Yeah, and then people are at different stages or different places in their lives is in regards to how much they want to reveal, how vulnerable they want to be. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh my exactly. God. So I'm looking at the photo, the image behind you of Toni Morrison.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. So I'll describe that too for everybody. Is this one of your paintings? One of your creations?
Yeah, it's one of my paintings. Yeah.
Okay.
So I painted that 10 years ago, actually.
Okay.
I actually got to meet Toni Morrison. She signed The Bluest Eyes for me.
Oh, you did. Oh, my God.
And she is amazing. Like just full of warmth.
Mm-hmm.
You can feel the wisdom just, like, vibrating off of her, just radiating. And, like, her locks are so beautiful. Oh, my God. Like, yeah.
Yeah.
And, yeah, and, like, just, like, her whole demeanor is just, like, peaceful. Like, you know, just calmness. Mm-hmm. Like, but like an ocean, you know?
Yeah.
Because it's like, you feel at peace, but you know there's so much depth to it.
Right.
You know what
mm-hmm.
I mean?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But at any minute, that ocean can turn into a heavy tide. You know what I mean?
Yeah, yes.
But only for the right things, you know what I mean? Like specifically mm-hmm. for white patriarchy, she will flood the place, you know what I mean? But
yes.
Anyways, so I did a series called 21 by 21,
mm-hmm.
where I made 21 paintings. About 21 people who inspired me.
Okay.
And so I read Fear for Books at that time.
Mm-hmm.
I don't remember which three books it was, because I read all of her books now.
Right.
But Bluest Eyes was one of them.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember reading that book, and when I closed it, I was like, whatever black woman I love, mm-hmm. I want her to feel completely proud to be black. You know, I wanted to completely feel honored to be in the skin that she's in, you know?
Yes.
And to have the depth of her, the eye color that she has, you know? And and so I made this piece using a ballpoint pen.
Okay.
On a washed wood. Mm-hmm. So I glazed the wood with a blue paint. To still, like, if you see it up close, you can still see the wood texture.
Okay.
And then I used a ballpoint pen to paint her in a few different ways, you know. And so we have her one facing straight on, but she's looking sideways. And she has a twinkle in the eye, and then one where she's looking up into the heavens, where it's like this. Because she kind of, like, when she talks, she always looks up.
Right,
and then she comes
right.
back down and talks to you. And I just felt like that was, like, so, like, angelic, because it's like she's, like, downloading or uploading.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And then she's delivering, you know? And so I wanted to represent that. And then the other one is one of her famous pictures where she's cupping her face and she's, like, staring
this
at
one
you.
Right here.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. That's great.
And so, yeah.
Yeah, she was instrumental to, I think, what I call the beginning of my awakening, because I was taking this African-American literature course over a summer in at University of South Carolina, Aiken. So I was raised in Augusta. Aiken is like an hour away, and I was just wanted to take some summer courses. And one of the books we read was Beloved. And that book, it broke through these walls I didn't know I had. I was 19, and at the end of it, when you know, Beloved has left, and it's just Paul D and Setha, and Setha, she's weeping the loss of Beloved, and she tells Paul D, you know, she was my best thing. And then Paul D says to her, no, you are your best thing. Woo! Yeah. Still sends chills, and I'm like, oh my God, particularly like him saying it to a black woman during that time, particularly during that time, but even like thinking about today, just think how like black women work and sacrifice on so many levels. And he's telling her, like, you are your best thing. Yeah, and that was such a declaration and revelation to me that I am still, like all these many years later, still learning to uncover. And yeah, it's an ongoing process. Absolutely, absolutely. Okay, so I was distracted by the beautiful Tony. May she rest in power. Okay, so I want to talk to you about the Black Speculative Arts Movement Institute of Canada, or Canadian Institute, or I don't think I wrote it down right, but yes, tell us about this organization that created.
So I got involved. I'm one of the founding members of the Black Speculative Arts Movement, which started in Harlem, New York, on the actual anniversary of the Harlem Renaissance. At the Schomburg Research Center. It was an art exhibition.
Yes.
Yeah, it was an art exhibition that I was a part of. And I think it was 89 artists from across America. And I was the only foreigner. I was the only person from Canada in the exhibition. And it was beautiful because the conversation that happened was how diverse Afrofuturism is, how diverse Black speculative content is, and how it varies in different regions, but also the importance to, again, make sure that Blackness is not represented as a monolith.
Right.
And so I was invited to speak in St. Louis by Dr. Renato Anderson, who is the overseeing, he's like the Nick Fury, as we call him, you know, of the BSAM Avengers. And and at that event, I spoke about, I called it Black Future Things, which Black Future Things for the North, I think. And essentially, I was just talking about the work that I was doing in Canada, specifically in Toronto, in the greater Toronto area
right.
At the time. And that was just before I moved to Montreal. Well, moved to Gatineau, which is just outside of Ottawa, which is the capital. I'm explaining all this because I know people don't know geography.
Yes, I know. Well, the Germans the Americans definitely don't. But, sorry, so, Americans.
So Ottawa is the capital of Canada, for those who don't know. And it's also a big city with a lot of black people as well. Folks don't know. It's we have a prime minister as well.
Uh-huh.
And not a president. And he lives in Ottawa.
Yes.
And we don't have a White House. We call it Capitol Hill, called Parliament. Mm-hmm. Similar to UK, if people know where UK is.
Yes.
Because we're a colony of UK, if you didn't know.
Yes.
But anyways, this is beside the point. So I moved, and that's how the Black Speculative Arts Movement Canada began, because I started to move to different places in Canada because I was engaging. I was being contracted to work in different communities,
right,
and do different art education work. And so I found myself in Montreal, and I was like, yo, the blackness here? Because that's when I started to learn about Matthew DaCosta, started to learn about all these black francophones who've been in Canada, who weren't slaves. So they're like, yo, what is the slave narrative? Like, they're like, je ne sais quoi, you know? Like, what is that? Like, you know what I mean? They're like, je ne sais pas, like, you know? They're like, this is not us. Like, they're like, what is this slavery thing you coming with? Like, nah, like, we don't have that, like, you know?
Like, I don't think so.
And then they like then they have like a strong Haitian population as well.
Right.
So then they're coming there with a sac passé, ma boule, like, you know what I mean? So they're coming with a strong like Haitian pride and stuff like that. And so for me, coming from like Toronto, which is like very Jamaican and Guyanese dominant, like it was very like it was a stark difference, like, you know. So it was beautiful. So anyways, that's what BSAM Canada was born. Like, I did the first BSAM Canada, did the first BSAM International event in Toronto in 2016.
Right.
Mm-hmm, but BSAM Canada was born in Montreal, because that's when I realized, like, yo, blackness in Canada itself is not the same. Like, you know what I mean?
Yes, it's different. Yes.
And so, like, I was like, yo, like, we need to have these francophone folks up in this, like, you know, like, up in this movement, up in this conversation around Afrofuturism. Because also, again, if we're talking about African people and the future, and we're talking about like this idea of like being informed by Africa, yo, we can't leave out the francophone African folks, because that's half of Africa.
It's a huge part. Exactly. Yeah.
Right. So we're talking about Burkina Faso. We're talking about Togo. We're talking about like Benin. We're talking like, you know what I mean? Niger. We're talking about the Congos. Like, you know what I mean? So anyways, so BSAM Canada is essentially creating a platform where when there is no platform. We don't have any black museums in Canada. We don't have any black historical black universities or colleges. So that's what BSAM Canada is.
No HBCUs in
Canada. No HBCUs, right? So systemic racism at its finest.
Yeah.
Which is crazy, because we could have had an HBCU. But again, because we lacked that unity, we didn't see the value in actually having a one particular institution. So there are different programs that speak to different populations, but there has never been one specific institution.
Right.
There has been like high school programs, which were like alternative schools, but never an institution itself. And so BSAM Canada Institute is working towards that. So we focus on projects, programs, and partnerships. And through those three aspects, we focus it on elevating, educating, and evolving the art platform for Black Canadians and for Black people in general. Because we recognize that it is very Afrocentric and is very much at our core to learn through the arts.
Yes.
That is the basis of our people.
Right, yes.
Right, on all
no
matter where you go, it's universal. We learn through the arts. We're able to survive through the arts, whether it's Negro spirituals, whether it's drumming, whether it's dance, you know what I mean? Whether it's through visual art, whether it's through monuments, that is our language, you know what I mean?
Right.
Our language was visual. It was art first, before anything else.
Anything, right? Exactly, right.
And so, like, if you think of the griots didn't just tell a story by speaking, they performed it. It was a poem. It was a song. It was a, it, you know what I mean? So I'm saying all that to say, like, we realize that art needs to be the thing that unifies us once again, right? And we see that with music, right? Mm-hmm. Music is, like, right now in this current epoch, in this current era, is our strongest weapon, right? Mm-hmm. Hip-hop, R&B, reggae, soca, afro beats, like, you know what I mean? That is taking the world by storm right now.
Yeah.
You know? Jazz was doing that at one point in time. Mm-hmm. You know, rock and roll, which came from black people, was doing it at
one point. Yeah, that came from the blues. Yeah.
Right? Mm-hmm. So, you know, the gospels, et cetera, et cetera. Right? So, so we use art as that catalyst to essentially create the changes that we want to see.
Right.
Yeah. But through an Afrofuturistic lens, you know? Mm-hmm. So, again, using imagination.
Right. So I wanted to ask, kind of back up a little bit, the differences. Can you kind of go into some of the differences between like Afrofuturism and Afrofuturism in Canada and African futurism? just kind of, can you articulate some of those? Just so particularly because, you know, being from the U.S., you know, I admit I have like a U.S. centric view of Afrofuturism, because like that's the only lens I've seen it through. So help me to expand my vision.
I mean, that's a hard thing for me to answer, because I don't want to generalize, but on a general scale, Afrofuturism in Canada, from the Canadian, Black Canadian perspective, again, is about coexistence, because we recognize that we're on Indigenous lands and that we are not the originators here, you know? Or the term that we use is the original caretakers or the custodians of the territories, you know? So within that, we recognize that Afrofuturism is Indigenous futurism, because our fates are very much tied, you know what I mean? In order to decolonize this place, we both need to recognize each other's futures, you know, and sustainability, et cetera, right? But it's still acknowledging that we are focused on the land, you know? So it's not just the people, it's the people that live off the land. So it's like, yo, we can't have no future if there's no land, you know, simple as that. It's hard for me to define North America. I mean, American, U.S., United States of America, Afrofuturistic perspective, because it's so vast. But I would say it's very much informed by technology is what I've seen. And that technology varies, you know. And I think of Isaiah Lavender III. He came up with an amazing book recently on Afrofuturism. He speaks to the history of it, but he speaks about different type of technologies. And oftentimes when we think of technology, we think of like just electrical devices, technologies. But really, technology is the extension of the body. So anything that's an extension, yeah. So the microphone is the extension of your voice. My glasses is the extension of my eyes. You know, the computer is the extension of your brain, et cetera, et cetera. So, so a lot of these things are different type of extensions of oneself. And a lot of it, from the American perspective, kind of speaks to this idea of slavery being an interruption in that extension. So not to say that it's centered around slavery, because really Afrofuturism is we have a future despite slavery. We have a future despite of what happened to us. You know what I mean? Despite the interruption, you know? Whereas Mike Derry, where he effed up, or where he slipped up, is he made it seem like, oh, y'all think about the future because y'all have no past. That's basically what he said. That's basically what Mike Derry said, which is why we scrapped his definition. You know what I mean? And now we're on the Afrofuturism 2.0, where we're looking at Pan-Africanism. And so African futurism is more larger, because obviously there's more of them, you know what I mean? And it's more diverse, you know? Exactly. A lot of countries, a lot of ethnic groups. So ethnicity is seen it differently, but it's still very Pan-African. And one of the most common things I've, I'm I'm coming across within African futurism is mobility, accessibility, and also sustainability. Because the general, again, I'm generalizing, the general consensus from the different African voices that I've heard from BSAM and otherwise, is there's a recognition that the way that Africans are going and African nations are going is not sustainable, because it's still operating from a colonialistic standpoint. So the politics is always going to be backwards. And so they need to recognize that mobility, accessibility, sustainability is something that needs to be pushed to the forefront. For many groups there, like, their history wasn't interrupted. It's the politics that was interrupted. It's the mobility that was interrupted. It's the accessibility that was interrupted. It's the sustainability that was interrupted. So that's why I use those 3 points, because that's the common factor amongst a lot of African folks. Yeah. But then also then there's Afrofuturismo.
Right?
Afrofuturismo.
Okay, so what is that?
Now this is like the South American. This is now the Spanish speaking the Latin inspired, okay. You know what I mean? So we're talking Brazil.
Yeah, because there are a lot of South Americans of African descent who are actually beginning to claim that African descent.
Exactly, right?
Okay.
So, because remember, Brazil and Colombia actually has one of the largest African population outside of America and outside of the continent, right? So, like, it's huge population numbers. And so, I'm still learning about Afrofuturism.
Okay.
I don't speak Spanish. Or Portuguese.
Yeah.
But I know it is very much reflective of the Canadian standpoint, because a lot of them see themselves as being mixed with indigenous practices and indigenous knowledges. So there's this aspect of Sankofanology that still takes place, where they're connected with their African roots, but they're also connected with the indigenous roots of the Americas.
Okay.
And so we're seeing that also within the Caribbean as well. So I don't know what they're going to call it, but, you know,
they'll come up with a name and we'll start using it. And
they're going to come up with their own flavor, you know, their own seasoning.
Exactly. Okay, so now I want to talk about your current project that's Missing Black Techno Fossils Here. So
This came out of my relationship with the Goethe Institute. I got accepted into an international residency called Monument Lab, and they have a partnership with the Goethe Institute. And essentially, we're looking at public's memory, you know, and memory keeping. And again, like I know I'm bringing it up, Matthew DaCosta, a lot of times in this conversation.
That's all right. People will remember his name now.
Yeah. And so I recognize that there is so much history in Canada about Black people here that is not celebrated in the public sphere. And for me, in my vision of the Afrotopia, it's a space where Black people can see themselves reflected in the landscape. Where you can go and see yourself on a billboard. You can go and see a statue of someone who might look like your auntie or your uncle or whatever. You know what I mean? But you see yourself reflected. You know, you see your histories, your legacies, your ancestries reflected. And that also represents a sense of investment. And so for the last 10 years, I've been doing this research on, like, what are the monuments? What are the public spaces? What are the spaces that preserve these memories? And so I look at monuments as a technofossil. A technofossil, as a simple definition, is any human-made artifact that is made out of material that was manipulated or created by humans. And so that's alloys, that's different alloy metals. So, like, bronze, when you melt gold, because that's not in its natural state, that was manipulated, et cetera, right? And so a technofossil, when the term was originally used, it was referred to, like, things like cell phones, because a cell phone doesn't decompose, right? Which is a scary thought. It's a scary thought when you think about it, because
especially if you read it to Octavia Butler.
So. Exactly. If you drop a cell phone in cement or in the bottom of the ocean, like some Titanic jump off type of thing, someone can still, in 1,000 years from now, still retrieve your information, because none of that stuff decomposes. So they can still extract your data and learn about you. And essentially, monuments are the same thing. And for me, from an Afrofuturistic standpoint, I recognize that monuments are very Afrofuturistic because, one, if you look at ancient Africa, we were making monuments before anybody else. In fact, everything that we call neoclassical or classical came from Egypt, because the Greeks and the Romans copied the Egyptians, who copied the Congolese, ancient Congo, right? So monument making is a very much an Afrocentric practice, despite the propaganda of the Eurocentric practices of the early 1600s onwards, right? Missing Black technofossils here is basically looking at what are the missing data from our public spheres. And so I'm looking at stuff like, why isn't there a monument or some type of tributary to Marcus Garvey, who opened up hundreds of centers across Canada, you know? Because when he first was starting the UNIA, Canada was his one of his key places that he went to, right? Because so many people from Jamaica was going to Canada. So he first started to build UNIA, hence Malcolm X, whose parents lived in Montreal. That's how they got involved. This is how they became Garveyites.
Yeah, that's right. Because he was his father was a Garveyite, but I didn't realize they lived in Canada.
Yeah, they came to Canada for a bit and then went back.
And they went back. Okay.
Yeah. So
I say all that to say, there's so much history that is not being told, right? And a lot of it doesn't have to deal with slavery, because again, those who are descendants of Matthew Da Costa, their stories are not being told, right? So the Black Arcadians, which are the descendants of people who came through France, right, who wasn't enslaved. So there's a whole narrative and collection of narratives that are yet to be told. And so this project just takes a glimpse at some of these narratives. And then also I created an augmented reality.
Yes. So talk about what's the experience of as a participant going into that space?
Yeah, absolutely. So
essentially, because it costs money to make monuments, I was like, yo, let me make a double technofossil by making a digital monument that pays homage to multiple ancestors at once. And so I made through protocol, through checking in with my elders, I made a monument that contains two African masks, like a Siamese mask. One is from Ghana and one is from Ivory Coast, to represent the two main coasts that we were extracted from. But also both those places, those ethnic groups that I reference, they have ceremonial ancestor masks. So when the masquerader puts on that mask, he or she are embodying that African ancestor, and they usually have a message for the person. So again, Sankofanology is at play, because you put on this mask and you transform through time, because you are no longer you. You are now who are you? You're the spirit you're embodying, and you are delivering a message for someone in the present to carry for the future. And so, so I use that reference because these virtual monuments, I want people to feel like they are connecting back to the past, to inform the present, to bring it to the future, you know? And so the experience is, people will go to these sites that I selected, the 6 sites in both cities, Montreal and Toronto, and they will go to these sites and they will activate the AR on their phone or their device, tablet, and they will get to hear the stories of these ancestors or this site as it relates to the missing technofossil, the missing information, the missing data in that space. And then they can have the choice of using the augmented reality to capture that moment, document, essentially, right? And so you can then also have the choice, if you want to, upload it either to my website, which is blacktechnofossils.com, or to social media, or just send it to your friends, or do nothing with it. But now you have that choice. You have the option to be a part of history, essentially, and be a part of this documenting database, essentially. And so what I want people to do to get to a point to is start suggesting places and leaders who deserves monuments but don't have any across Canada. Yeah, and then so essentially we would have a whole map across the country.
And you could essentially go with your phone and do your own tour in a way.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's education outside of outside of the institution.
Wow, that's great. It kind of reminds me just but more in a more advanced version of and there was this documentary about Audre Lorde called Audre Lorde in Berlin. And in conjunction with the documentary, there's an app you can download on your phone. So when you're in Berlin, you can actually travel and go to the places where she visited.
Dope.
So it maps you the route there. And then like when you get there, you look on your phone, there's a little history of it, you know, some event that was relevant to Audre Lorde's time there. So, but this is more significantly more advanced in that. Yeah. Than that. So, but yeah, that's great. That's great. So right now they can visit, 6 sites and you're in the prototype stage, right?
Yeah. So, okay. So there's a Google map that you can go to. So, you know, if you're not in Canada, which you probably wouldn't be.
Yeah. Not for a while, unfortunately.
So you can still have, in November. Yes. So you can still have the virtual experience. Through the Google Maps, so you can still use the AR no matter where you are.
Okay.
Through the website, yeah.
Okay, great. So what do you want that to evolve to look like, to be?
To be honest, I can't answer that just because the idea of this project came to me through a dream. Essentially, I feel like it was inspired by the ancestors saying like, you need to tell some of our stories. And so I don't know where this is going to go because, you know, they say humans make plans and God laugh at it. You know what I mean? So, and then, so I do think the same with the ancestors, you know, when they have an idea and you want to do something with their idea, they're going to be like, yo, you're too small. You know what I mean? Your idea too small.
Right. Exactly. Okay. Well, we're about near time. So we always like to give our guests the last word. So do you have any final thoughts? Anything else you'd like to share with us to kind of close us out?
My final thoughts is just to remind people that they are an ancestor. And you have the choice right now, wherever you are, wherever you're hearing my voice, wherever you listen to this podcast, to decide what side of history you want to be a part of. And also, no matter what you're going through, just know that you have all the tools that you need to get through it.
Yeah.
All right. Amen and ashe. All right. Thank you, Quentin.
Yeah. Blessings. Don't know.
Afrofuturism has long been in the musical and literary space. And now Quentin, with his Missing Black Techno Fossils here, is bringing Afrofuturism to VR in a way that honors those who have come before us and points us to a future rooted in a true understanding of our histories. Those of us who work in the documentary space are recording memories. We're creating historical records and celebrating stories that have been disappeared. This is a responsibility that those of us who are from underrepresented communities take seriously. We know our bodies aren't commodities to be traded, and neither are our stories. We are the keepers of this plane.